So this is a podcast from the IWA. I'm Auriel Miller, Director of the IWA, and with me I've got Chris Johns, Chief Executive of Building Communities Trust, and Sarah Lloyd-Jones, Director of the People and Work Unit. Chris and Sarah are here because we have there's an event being run tomorrow by Building Communities Trust and Centre for Local Economic Strategies, looking at how to build a new economy for Wales. And we at the IWA hosted a blog last month in September on the issues that the event will cover, and we wanted to just pick up on some of those issues and ideas with the two of you. So obviously the background to this conversation is how, after years of recession followed by austerity, the public sector has become less able to support the local economy, especially in areas where private sector activity is lower. So new ideas, approaches, and new practices is starting to emerge. And that's one of the objectives for tomorrow's event, Chris, isn't it? To share some of what's been going on.
Absolutely.
So could you set out some of those headline issues, please, for listeners, Chris?
I think the key point, actually, is that we have some under-realised potential here. In relation to the challenges you set out, actually, many people in communities, particularly communities away from the economic centres, have actually taken initiatives to build community economic wealth, to retain jobs in their areas. That's not just been community organisations, it's also been private companies as well. But we've actually seen a degree of initiative and local economic activity that probably wasn't there 5 or 6 years ago, and increasingly diverse. And what we really feel is that there is underappreciation of how much is being achieved. And a lot of what we're trying to do tomorrow is to not only share that success, but understand the reasons why that success has happened and look at what is needed to allow more of it to happen. Mm.
So have you done some of the thinking about some of those reasons, and are you expecting that to be pulled out of tomorrow's conversations?
Yes, I mean, some of those reasons are about people fully taking advantage of the assets in the areas they live, so recognising what the local environment can offer in terms of anything from renewable energy to tourism. Some of it is about people who weren't effectively working together previously now getting together. Some of it is about leverage on external private sector investors being used more effectively.
So examples of practical, concrete things that are happening across Wales, can you give us a couple of examples so people can get a sense of what you're talking about?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the really interesting stories you'll hear tomorrow is from Treorchy, where you've had a community organisation that has, after a lot of negotiation, secured access to NRW-owned woodland. They're using
Natural Resources
Wales Woodland. Yeah. Yes, sorry. They're using that for skills training and relevant skills. They're using the wood there for as a resource for small business development, and then they're also looking at hydro energy. Another really interesting example is everyone knows about the zip wires in Blaenau-Ffestiniog.
Yep.
What people don't necessarily know is about how local businesses and local community organisations have actually secured much greater local spend in the locality from visitors by actually making sure there are other facilities to visit, decent restaurants, places to stay, a community-owned mountain bike track, which it means that people aren't just coming through the zip wire, they're actually spending more time and more money in the area.
So it's about putting a series of resources around a central attraction, which is pulling in that.
Yeah, and also the community actually negotiating quite hard with the owners of that central attraction, who weren't necessarily particularly interested in the locality to start with.
Yeah.
It was just a place they could run their activity.
So different sorts of partnerships and
Absolutely.
A leverage being used in a different way.
Yeah.
Sarah, you're presenting at the conference tomorrow as well. Can you tell us a little bit about your perspective on these issues?
Well, I'm really sort of focusing in on the processes of engaging communities,
right,
and how people get involved, and the value of that the engagement of communities, both because of looking at some of the kind of enduring cross-generational impacts of poverty, and how that they become both symptoms and causes over time of poverty, things like poor education attainment, mental and physical health issues that become legacies, but also causal factors, issues around loneliness and isolation, and poverty of social networks, and how really quite low-level work that is maybe tackling some of those things can over time lead into the kind of economic development work that Chris is talking about, but that these two things are completely interrelated.
Yeah.
And so things that may seem luxuries, you know, Christmas fairs or beer and pizza evenings or whatever, become actually the flagstones, the basis against which a lot of community development and community involvement can grow.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about some of the practical work for people who are listening to this who may not be able to get a handle on what does that look like in practice? What kinds of things are projects or groups or communities doing that you can say, here's a good example of what I mean?
I think you know, it is that process of you start with either something that is really good fun, that is going to get people out, because neighbours need to meet each other,
yeah,
and they need,
yeah,
to get to know each other. Or a cause, an issue that really matters to people. Something, you know, it can be something like the threat to a local school, it can be things like threat to a local hospital or something. Things that actually really matter to people, that cause them to come together. And that once people start to come together, you have a basis on which to start getting conversations going, to start providing opportunities for people to challenge their limits in a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be running short courses in the community. It could be running some kind of joint community activity where people have to get engaged in organising something. But the key part of it, I think, is that is not necessarily an end of itself. It's that this becomes part of a process that then takes people onto another stage.
It's building the trust and the relationships, isn't it, that enables,
yeah,
a different conversation to happen, at which point then you are able to identify and recognise the kind of assets that are in that, mm, community that you can use to get the leverage that you're talking about, Chris. Is that the connections that you see between those?
That has certainly been true in the two examples I've talked about, and we can think of others. But occasionally, of course, what you'll see is one or two people, in a sense, acting as entrepreneurs, setting up something, and then maybe other people coming on to join them later.
Mm-hmm.
And to a large extent, whether those entrepreneurs are in the social sector or the private sector is less important than whether they're willing to build the relationships to take,
yeah,
it further.
Yeah, because you and I have talked before in on other occasions about how that sort of social change happens, haven't we, around what does it take? Does it take a mover and a shaker to do something, or is it the softly, softly engagement work that you're talking about, Sarah, that builds and builds and builds over time? Or is it the spotting an opportunity and somebody cutting to it and thinking, actually, around this, we can build something together?
It's a mix.
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of four or five examples, all of which are slightly different. You certainly need people who are willing to take a risk, do something new and different. Whether they're doing that as one individual or whether they're doing that as a group of people will often vary from place to place and opportunity to opportunity.
So are you beginning to see what sort of prerequisites have to be in place to enable that to happen? Is it because people have time, people are financially secure so they can do some of this other stuff on the side, so to speak? Or is it because they've got those sorts of networks that they can pull in the sorts of resources they need? I'm not trying to impose any kind of model on it, but are there some factors that make it more likely for things to succeed?
I think having a degree of recognition within your locality is quite an important one, so that people will listen to you. Even if they don't come along and support you straight away, it means when you've got something to say, people will listen. Finding time from somewhere, as you suggest, is essential. Some people can also manage to do it within the confines of their own jobs, depending,
yeah,
on what their job is.
Yeah.
Other people may be retired, other people may not, may be working part-time or whatever. I think that's an important one. And knowing who you can link up with.
So the networking aspect,
yeah,
of it.
I think one of the other really important things, though, is some availability of space to either do things in. And it's quite noticeable that almost all the places where some of these developments have happened have had some degree of public space, which might be around places where people meet and discuss things, it might be where people do things, but it's very hard, it doesn't seem to be as prevalent a type of development in areas where there is no physical space available. Which is interesting why some of the kind of smaller valleys, towns, which have quite mixed usages of space actually, often are quite productive for community activity.
Because they're recognised places where people can come together and there ideas can be forged.
There is that, but there is also physical space to do things. If you're on a very large housing estate, which is literally just houses and the odd shop, that's actually much more challenging.
Yeah, so actually it's a reminder to people to think about where can that conversation happen.
Yes,
literally,
indeed.
Literally, physically, where
as well as finding the physical assets on which you can develop.
Yeah. When in the blog, you and Neil from the Centre for Local Economic Studies talked about some of the virtuous circle of inputs that can be strengthened through this sort of approach. So thinking about the foundational economy, and there's a lot more about that, isn't there, in the ether at the moment in Wales on the one hand. And I guess the question I'm coming to is, how does this play into some of those really big ticket issues for Wales that go beyond what people might see as a purely economic perspective into well-being and into the kind of social returns that we want to see for where we live? So it's not a binary choice between social and economic development, is it anymore? It's a totally different way of
absolutely not. And in some ways, I think one of the reasons why these enterprises in their different forms have been underplayed is because they don't deliver on the surface the economic benefits of potential orthodox private sector work.
So it's what value is being placed on it. In as much as things are planable, A, does that matter that you have to plan it out? Because actually when you're putting together, or historically when we've been putting together proposals on things, you need to be able to see, well, these are the planned outputs and these are the planned outcomes and this is the impact of what we want to achieve. And actually what you're saying then is that those sorts of outputs and outcomes and the impact, we need to measure it very differently.
Yeah, well, certainly, if you're measuring it in a holistic way that you've just been describing, then they're actually delivering a lot. If you're looking at it purely, if you're just saying it's about a local economy and you're purely looking at it in economic metrics, then it's not delivering as much. There will be jobs involved, there will be wealth retained, but it won't be at a spectacular level. But the well-being benefits, in many cases, will be significantly greater.
And are you seeing that sort of argument getting traction, being picked up, or do you think that that sort of policy conversation environment needs to shift dramatically to enable that to happen?
I think the policy conversation is still in its early stages, would be the politest way I would put it. I think the other thing is, to be honest, for all the discussions about outcomes and output, many of these successful initiatives have not been built on the back of public funding. So in a sense, that's not a discussion many of them have had yet.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it? And certainly my reflection since returning to work in Wales 4 years ago was there is a big assumption that change and social change is driven by Welsh Government, and I'm getting nods from both of you on this, and that actually isn't necessarily the case. Sarah, do you want to talk a little bit more about
actually, in many ways, it's stronger and more sustainable if it isn't externally driven and externally funded. And I think, you know, one of the lessons we need to really look at from Communities First is to actually identify, well, where has it led to sustainable change and what have been the factors? And very often the factors have been a pull away from the driver that was coming from sort of central policy. And that even really quite effective work that was done under the Communities First banner is potentially at risk now when the funding is going, because there isn't necessarily that sustainability, because a lot of it relies on paid posts, relies on that whole kind of funded structure, which is not really going to be viable. Certainly isn't going to be viable in the future.
So if you were to remodel things much more radically, what would be your direction of travel? What would you do?
I think we need to be much more conscious of the ways in which communities can come together. And I think the key thing is not to do harm, to just allow these things to happen, and ideally to provide some kind of support. You know, one of the things that Chris and I have discussed on a number of occasions is that in nearly all communities where something is really starting to develop. There is some form of an anchor organisation.
Yeah.
An organisation, you know, which might be very, very different in form, very different in its core function, but the commonality is that it functions as, you know, perhaps providing a place where people can meet, perhaps providing some kind of structural support to enable people to meet, providing information, providing some level of guidance. And I think we need to recognise that and to provide support to those bodies and those organisations that are there.
So I've heard Ted Howard speak. I'm not sure if he's coming.
He's speaking tomorrow by video link.
Yeah. Okay. So I've heard him talk about the work that they've done through the Democracy Collaborative in the States. I think it's Ohio in particular, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
About the role of hospitals in that, as that anchor. So yeah. What you're saying there is it doesn't need to be the government. It could be another institution that recognises the role it has to play in a community and wants to both inhabit that role and make the most of it and look at all those win-win-win situations, but enable that throughput of both ideas and energy and thinking about how the procurement system, for instance, could work differently, how the recruitment system could work differently to people living in that community who aren't necessarily coming in from outside. Is there somewhere that you can recommend that people go and learn about that kind of approach, or will there be?
You'll find out quite a lot about the Preston example in particular tomorrow.
Yeah.
On a smaller scale, quite interesting is the work of the Community Council in Bethesda, which is levering its resources very effectively for local benefit.
Do you want to just explain a little bit about the Preston model for the sake of?
Yes, the Preston model has been very much focused on looking at what the local authority and then drawing in other partners who work in the area, including the police and hospitals and the county council, can do with their local budget and actually to try and maximise the local benefits. So not necessarily always looking at the cheapest suppliers, but looking at the suppliers who will not only give you a decent service, but actually provide the maximum economic benefit to the area. So local companies, local employment, local sourcing, what they can do for local supply chains, for bigger providers, are all fairly key in that.
And that presumably would have taken quite a sea change in terms of the tendering process, the mechanics of it, and getting the mindset and the attitude towards this is not about the financial bottom, it's not only about the financial bottom line anymore. This is about a much bigger...
That's right. And in some ways, one of the problems in Wales is that procurement itself is now done on the cheap. So you need quite a sophisticated approach to procurement and a willingness to actually take risks beyond the way it's always been done. And whether public bodies in Wales are set up to do that, I think, is open to question. But it does mean that they are not able to take advantage of the opportunities to maximise local benefit.
So I'm hesitant to mention the B word in this particular context, but does Brexit then offer opportunities? No,
it doesn't offer opportunities at all. I mean, I think we've hidden behind European procurement regulations as an excuse for quite a long time. We've clearly seen plenty of examples of people not understanding procurement regulations and having very different opportunities understandings from place to place, even within Wales. But frankly, if Preston can do it now, anybody else in Europe can do it now. The European laws are not the barrier here.
So it's about how you use them and your understanding of how they can be applied.
Yes, and your expertise to actually do the more sophisticated procurement.
Yeah.
The opportunity, which is actually in the regionalisation of local government, is whether local governments can actually pool procurement expertise to actually make this happen. The risk there, of course, is that you pool stuff and then you buy on a bigger scale. But if you pool stuff to bring together a more equipped team of procurement experts, you could actually procure local and smarter. Because it's very difficult for small teams to do this.
Because the local authorities could say with some justification that their resources have been so...
Oh, no, absolutely. I have a lot of sympathy, here. But it's been almost a false economy.
Yeah.
But that false economy has been almost forced on them.
Yeah. Sarah, you were...
Well, I was just going to say that I do think their potential is, though, in theory at least, an opportunity in relation to the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, because it is requiring, in theory, people to behave differently and to be looking much more at sustainable development and development that actually does involve a whole range of agencies and thinking about things in a different way.
And that, I think, was something that came through very clearly from a conversation in a different context around infrastructure and infrastructure development in Wales that we facilitated a few weeks ago, when that the shift away from that binary decision, what's better, is it about the economy or is it about the social benefits? That conversation needs to totally move and morph into something, something very different. Well, we wish you luck with the conference tomorrow, and thank you very much, both of you, Chris Johns and Sarah Lovejoins, for taking part in today's podcast.